Hello, you're listening to a podcast of the best bits of Breakfasters for the week ending Friday the 20th of Feb. We're broadcast live on Triple R from Melbourne, Wurundjeri Country, Australia. On this podcast, Besha Odell dips into the K-curve and how it's influencing pricing on the culinary landscape, while Dr. Nij Lal empowers young people navigating the online world with his new book, Behind the Scenes.
Talking movies, Megan McHugh brought us the bonkers survivor horror thriller Send Help, and Dr. Jen gave us the new weird science on coffee.
A very zen Oliver Coleman dropped in to discuss everyone he couldn't stand at his meditation retreat, but we'll begin with me talking myself up. I won an award.
Triple R.
Won an award last night.
Oh, really?
Thank you. Just kicking it off with that.
Oh, what?
Yeah, I won the Australian Writers Guild Award for stand-up comedy.
Oh,
it's
amazing.
Category. It's new. Thank you so much. There were only two nominees, so
minor detail.
Funny. I kind of feel like I Stephen Brent.
Well, they should have been part of the guild.
They should have been. Yeah, you do have to. You got to pay a fee to enter this award, but that's fine.
Winner, chicken dinner.
Yeah, it's me and Nazim Hussain up for the award. So I don't know if
you'd smoke Nazim.
Well, sure did. No, I know. It looks good for me to beat Nazim, but Nazim to lose to me.
it's so
shocking.
What's the category? Best writing.
Yeah, so it's a...
They read the subtitles of the special.
Well, here's the thing. I had to write an actual script with stage directions in it, which was very strange.
Okay.
Because the show that I submitted, I had a whole section of the show where I basically told a story about how a guy sent me 50 dick pics.
What?
And then, I know, it's too many. It's too many. And a very round number, which is unsettling.
Yeah. It's like, it's almost like it was a name. Oh, yeah. I bet I can get the half century.
Yeah.
Raise the bat.
Raise the Didn't want to show disgusting. Off too much. Didn't want a full century.
Oh, my God.
It's disgusting.
Ran himself out.
Yeah. I'll call it there. Kate retired.
Kate walking. Retired
hurt. Yeah, I think he was hurt. I saw the photos. But so in the show, I showed my favourite one. Thought that was pretty funny.
Yeah. It's actually really funny.
Because fuck him, I guess. And yeah, so I had to write that into the script to be like, and then on the TV, there is a picture of a penis wearing reading glasses.
An award-winning penis.
An award-winning penis now, yeah.
That's so good. Wow.
Not bad.
Was there a ceremony? Did you get it via email?
No, there was a ceremony last night in Sydney, so I couldn't go. So friend of the show, Irvi Majumdar, accepted on my behalf.
Nice.
Yes. She had a nomination for her show, Irvi Goes to an All-Girls School.
In a different category.
In a different category, yeah. That one wasn't stand-up. Yeah, so Irvi accepted on my behalf, which was very lovely of her. I wrote her a speech with a couple of dick jokes. Hopefully they didn't bomb on the night.
Where was the event, do we know?
NIDA.
Oh, wow. So good.
Yeah, you'd think they'd be more interested in performing. But
yeah. So that's the school. It's in their auditorium.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I know, fancy.
So now you're like an award win. You can spin this somehow.
Spin this.
Well, you won an award at NIDA.
I won an award at NIDA. I did.
NIDA award winning.
Don't probe any further.
Yeah.
I won an award at NIDA.
The new Rose Byrne.
Yeah, that's it.
Look, yeah. That's amazing.
Thank you so much. Yeah, so that's my whole thing.
So you gave Irvi instructions.
I gave Irvi instructions.
And do you know how long, what was her report? Did she get nervous? I wonder what it's like to accept an award on behalf of someone else.
Yeah, she said she was very nervous.
Mm.
I guess she was like, I really don't want to stuff up your speech. And I was like, it's not a very good speech. Improvise if you must.
Mm.
And yeah, so she got up, she did it. I get a little trophy this time, which is exciting.
Yeah.
Hopefully that comes back. I'll have to chase Irvy up for that. Yeah.
Can we do a little, maybe we can get Irvy in and do a little presentation.
Do a presentation. Yeah, let's do it. Just
to build it
up,
you know.
Yeah, so I can have my moment.
Yeah, get that gusto.
Because I was almost thinking I can duck down to Sydney and then get, and I was like, I'm not doing that again.
Mm.
I don't think I could do it.
What's the Writers Guild trophy? Do you know?
It looks like a little glass triangle type thing.
Oh, they're the best ones.
They're the best
Street,
ones.
Modesty. Yeah. It's like a humble trophy. They're like,
get it. Where should it go in the house, do you reckon? Maybe by the TV.
Front door.
Front door as you walk in. I'll replace the door handle with the trophy and you have to like turn it to get
yes,
in the door.
Please. So there'll be there's one. A felt bottom.
Oh, I imagine so. I hope so.
So you're aware of it because you've seen a photo of this year or you know previously?
No, we watched the little live stream last night and, oh my God, what a joy, comedy first category up, turned it off after.
Yes, that's what you want in an awards ceremony.
Yeah, you want to be done first. So Irvy was done. I think she was on the beers straight away, and then I never heard from her again for the rest of the night, which
awesome.
I think means it was a very good time.
That's
when
so
you say
good.
She was done, she was up for her own category. She didn't know she was done.
No, her category was done too.
All of comedy.
So all they were like, comedy. We're serious writers. We'll get this garbage out of the way first.
All the riffraff.
They do, yeah, get the
comedians.
Riffraff done, and then
we'll do our serious
and then we'll
drama
move on
school.
To the real stuff, to I the mean, dramas.
What is the rule with awards? Trophies, anything I've won is it like in it locked in a like a suitcase that I can't see. They get it their time in the sun, and it's been ages since I won anything. So and then gradually it becomes like, all right.
Well, yeah, because I think at some point people go, they look at the years and they go, and what have you done since?
Yeah.
And you go, forget it.
I've done. That's all you need to do.
They have an expiry, don't they? Yeah.
Job done. Don't need to keep doing more jobs.
Got to let other people win some awards.
Yeah. Think of a hoarder.
Yeah.
So when do you get it? When's Irvy back?
Whenever Irvy's back, yeah.
Oh, can we? Well,
she'll bring it in. Won't
we? We'll get her to bring it in here.
Yeah, yeah. Or otherwise,
at 6 a.m. Yeah. What are you doing between the hours of 6 and 9?
Or otherwise, I feel like some kind of sense of occasion, some kind of ceremony.
Yeah.
You could do it at the pub, could do it in here.
Would be fun. We could do the pub.
We'd do it on air.
Yeah, I reckon on air would be.
We're not going to the pub.
Oh,
to do
yeah, but we could go to the pub.
Come in as a Friday party and bring the award. This is obvious.
God, you really know how to put a dampener on
no,
things,
it'll
Dan.
That'll be fun. That'll be the most fun.
You're making it sound really fun. Guys, you'll sit here and you'll be quiet and you'll have fun. And you won't have any beers.
Yeah. Yeah, we can bring the beers. Nazeem, what like it's it was two of you. You obviously relieved you one. Were you what nervous watching the live stream?
I was nervous, yeah, which was weird because I was removed. I should have been have. A,
did it feel like an out of body experience?
Yeah, it was really strange. Mm. Liz wanted to watch it. I didn't even want to put it on. I had to leave the room.
Yeah, it's
when Irvy read the speech. God. Yeah, I was like, oh,
it is almost out of body. In yeah, that it's almost like a posthumous kind of award or something. You're like,
that is what it looks like when you get what I felt is what people feel like when they're in the in memoriam slideshow at the Oscars.
Yeah,
you're just like, oh,
looking down. Oh, they do. They are clapping for me. I did do a good job.
I did all right.
There you go.
Oh, they use that photo. Oh,
what did Irvy read off?
She off her phone.
Okay.
Whoa.
I don't know. I guess that's the way of the world.
That's.
Do you reckon bring in a scroll?
Well, I don't. I mean, I just emailed it to her. I didn't expect her to go to Office Works or print it off. But do you think she should have memorized it?
No. I don't know.
What would be your go-to? Notes on the hand?
Yeah.
The little dot points on the back of the hand.
Yeah, exactly. No, I don't know. I think a phone is fine because it also suggests this is ad hoc. And it takes the pressure off everybody.
Yeah.
Or a massive, massive book, like a full volume tome, and you just plonk it down on the lectern.
And some dust comes up when you put it.
And you just turn open page one and then you start the speech.
Have you ever seen the footage of Russell Crowe reading to the Rabbitohs football team? And he has a book I like that to. And he goes and blows dust off it and then he...
Get the full loss. Yeah. Yes. All right.
I was he reading the code of conduct? Why was he so dusty? That's crazy.
Yes. Amazing. Well, congratulations, yeah, Brian.
Thank you. Thanks, guys. That'll be it for a while, I think. Yeah.
We're going to string it out.
In the suitcase.
This is... we're going to get some leverage out of this for sure.
Yeah, let's drag it out. Let's milk it.
Yes, please.
Triple R on FM, digital, online and via the app.
Thanks so much for being here. It means a lot.
I'm hungry. I want something to eat. Something with a crunch and very sweet.
Well, for food include, what a treat to be joined by culinary cognoscenti, Besher O'Dell. Morning, Besher.
Good morning.
Where do you want to take us?
Well, I thought we should talk a little bit about restaurant pricing today because I feel as though there's kind of globally this conversation happening, but also here in Melbourne I'm seeing kind of two extremes where things are getting very expensive on the one hand, and then on the other end, for the first time I think really maybe since pre-COVID, we're seeing so many places that are super focused on almost extreme value, which is really interesting. It's interesting from an economic standpoint. I think there's an obvious cultural thing there. And then I feel like the middle is falling out a little bit. There's not as much that's just kind of, your regular.
The K curve has come
yes,
for the kitchen.
Yeah, I think so. When we talk about the global conversation, so Noma, widely kind of accepted to be the best restaurant in the world, is really in the middle of getting cancelled, like right now. A former employee there has, just gone on this social media, tirade and is getting all of these, reports of abuse and whatever. But the basic kind of underlying anger that's there, I think, is that they're in the middle of doing an LA pop-up, which costs $1,500 a person.
Okay.
Renee Redzepi, the chef there, has kind of very famously said, this is kind of the price of doing this type of dining. If you have, 20 people foraging for ants to, for every dish, then that's what it costs. But, and again, I haven't done any independent reporting on this or looked into it, but the word is that this guy has dug up some of the bank stuff and, Renee Redzepi is also very famous for not paying interns. Like, you go work at Noma for 3 months for free, because it gives you such clout to have that on your CV. But this guy has found out that, like, Renee Redzepi is actually worth a huge amount of money, and Noma itself is worth a huge, like, millions and millions and millions. What does it mean for somebody to go into a city like LA where the dining scene is really struggling? The fires that happened there, the ICE raids, has just so many places are closing, and just say, here we are, we're going to charge $1,500 a person, and the global elite is going to fly in from all corners of the world to eat a meal that without any drinks is going to cost a couple, $3,000 American, So, and I just think that maybe the era of that type of thing is coming to an end. I mean, I think that, there's always going to be people, apparently it's sold out in 3 minutes. I mean, I'm not sure that there's, manipulation you can do there, but I just think the backlash to that when people are struggling so much is just real,
Yeah.
And I do think that the economics of that level of fine dining is going to need to be rethought.
Yeah.
Especially in Melbourne, the middle is so enticing. It's what I'm most proud of.
Yes, absolutely. And we're really lucky for that. I think that that's something that I worry about. Like, that's something that I'm really concerned about, and I hope that we can maintain. Because again, I think if you look at Los Angeles, there isn't, you know, the middle is what's really struggling there. Like, there's lots of, you can still get a, you know, burrito for $5 that's better than most meals you'll get anywhere else. Mm. And you can go to these very fancy places, but that kind of like everyday dining is not. Whereas here in Melbourne, I think that everyday dining is what we do so well, that kind of wine bar or, you know, neighborhood joint kind of place. Which brings me to the other end of it, which is that I'm just seeing like all of these places that are kind of trying for kind of extreme value. And I should say here that I really shy away from kind of celebrating cheap eats as a genre because historically that has been mainly immigrant cuisine, and there's a devaluation of immigrant labor that's kind of inherent in the idea that your banh mi should only cost $7 or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I'm not talking about that. That's obviously been a model for those folks for generations. But I'm talking about Times New Roman in East Brunswick that just opened last year, and they have pasta for $6. You can get a bowl of pasta for $6. Like, now you can add sausage for another $6. You can, you know, or you can get a full bowl of pasta. But I just love the idea that they're like, come in, have a wine, mm-hmm. and just like, I don't necessarily want like a giant bowl of pasta. Mm. Like, I feel like there's so much generosity behind just the idea of that, even if I am like, I'm going to go and maybe I'll have 3 glasses of wine, yeah, you know, yeah. like, but just that, the thing that's like, you can come in and eat. And one of the people who kind of, started this was the Heart of Carlton, which is, on the corner of Carlton and Lygon and Elgin, and they, everything is $4. They do a sandwich, which is just basically a roll with, you know, salami and rocket, and it's $4. You can and get
it's delicious.
It's delicious. It's so simple.
Yeah,
and they have a line out the door. They also do pasta for $4, just a takeaway kind of thing of pasta, and so they're obviously making some money. I mean, I'm sure they're not getting rich, but like, I feel like economically it's working for them. I would be curious to see, but I think it's just, it's volume. Pasta is cheap. If you buy enough bread and meat, like, you can kind of do that.
The overheads get covered.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm personally such a sucker for the economics of reciprocity, where yes. if something is feels almost free, then yes. I'll tip the scales in the other direction.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a place that has just opened in the city called Frenchie that everything is $14. The drinks are $14. The food is $14. Everything's $14.
Wow.
And so I also love the idea of that like, you know, you just know what you're getting. I think that there's so much anxiety around going out to eat and being like, you know, what am I going to spend? Is this going to be the, you know, my son is in his 20s and is looking for a place to take his girlfriend for Valentine's. And he's just, you know, he's always like, you know, he's 22. He doesn't have any money. You know, he's like, I just don't want to spend $300 on this meal. You know, like, where can I go? And so I think the appeal of something like that is really, really huge. And I hope that there's a model in it. I hope that this, like, economically can work, because I don't want to see it, you know, make it so that wages aren't being paid or whatever it is. But I do think that when you look at, I mean, Times New Roman is just, you know, so full all the time. And I got to think that a lot of people there aren't just having the $6 pasta. They're having the $23 pasta. And again, having a couple cocktails maybe. But just the idea that they're offering that is really...
Well, when I was in London, I got the sense that this is old intel, but it was like, well, you can either eat well or have fried chicken.
Yeah.
And there was no, there really genuinely didn't seem to be anything that was on offer for the middle. And I'm wondering, what is it about Melbourne that might adapt around that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's really funny. I think we think of our cafe culture as being mainly coffee, that it has influenced us in that we have really good coffee. And it's a discussion for another day, because there's all this history involved in why our cafe culture is the way it is. But I think that the cafe culture plus the pub culture that was here even before the Italians arrived has kind of come together to create this idea that food should just be an everyday, you know, food and drink and being out in public, eating and drinking.
Socializing.
Yeah, is like a God-given right if you are in Melbourne, because there's always going to be a pub within a couple blocks. There's always going to be a cafe within a couple blocks that might morph into a wine bar in the afternoon that is really there for casual eating. And this is now hundreds of years old, these institutions, and have absolutely shaped the way that, not only the way that we eat, but the way that our city's laid out, the way that our neighborhoods are, you know. And we're really, really lucky. I mean, I sometimes think that Melbourneians kind of take it for granted. But, you know, again, having been away for so long and come back, that's the thing that for me is just priceless about living here, is that, you know, it isn't that big of a thing. If you're like, it's Thursday, I just don't want to cook, I can get a parma or a bowl of pasta really close by, you know, for under $30 almost anywhere in the city. And it's rare and it's beautiful.
Oh, know? Cafes and pubs are our bulwark.
It's true. Yeah. It's true.
Could chat forever. Love your work, Beshir Odell. And can't wait to read your next piece of work. Thanks very much.
Triple R.
Dr. Neeraj Lal is a physicist, energy researcher, podcaster, and children's author whose expertise has seen him invited to speak variously at Gippsland's Festival of Big Ideas, TEDx Sydney Sustainability Salon, and the Australian Singularity Summit. The award-winning science writer's timely new book is called Behind the Screens, How the Internet Works and How to Make It Work for You. And to tell us about it, the cattle farmhand turned solar cell nanophotonics expert joins us now. Neeraj, welcome to Breakfasters.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us about the impetus of this book and why you thought it was now's the moment.
Yeah, well, actually I was watching a doco back in the day. I don't know if you've seen it on Netflix, The Social Dilemma. It's
like, ah.
It was really cool. It was like a part dramatization, part interviews. And they looked at what happens on our socials and they looked at the algorithms behind it. And it's fascinating. They talked to a bunch of tech executives about it. And like amazing and a little bit scary. And I thought, oh, gee, wouldn't it be good if we could communicate that information to the people who are about to jump online now, you know, the ones who are engaging, who are about to engage before they've been echo chambered and rabbit holed and siloed. And so that was the motivation for writing the book.
Mm-hmm. And what's your analysis so far of the social media ban and its pickup seemingly globally?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there's a lot of support for it around the world. It's tricky. I think it's been tough for the people who have had the ban applied to them, the young people who have had something and then had it taken away. And I don't think we managed that transition well. But in some sense, the ban is not so much aimed at them. It's like, ah, oh, sorry, guys. It's aimed at the next generation coming through that have yet to get on there. And I think the language of the eSafety Commission is really helpful in this space. It's not so much a ban as a delay. It's not saying, hey, you know, never go swim in the ocean with big waves. It's like, oh, just wait until you can swim and, like, you know, learn how to spot a rip and swim between the flags and what to do if you get into trouble. And it's the same kind of thing to say, hey, not yet. Alongside a ban or a delay, I think equally important is the information that we can give young people to empower them, to get them ready, to be able to identify the hazards, what to do in this situation, how to make it work for me, for you, for the young people. And that's what the book aims to do.
Yeah. And how do you stop yourself from sounding like a finger-wagging old fart?
It's really hard. My kids tell me that I'm like a finger-wagging old fart. No. So, no, it's tricky. I think the approach, in my experience, is to start where the audience is and be really honest with them as much as you can. And we try that with the book. We really go there with the thorny topics. We talk about the difference between data and metadata, surveillance capitalism, how advertising works on the internet, what to do if someone asks you for a nude photo, VPNs, like all of it. Like, we really go there and try to balance that with, hey, look, there's some amazing stuff you can do on the internet too. Like, it's just such a part of our world. You kind of, it's like talking about air, you know. It's everywhere and there's beautiful and engaging and interesting and entertaining things that you can do on there. But there are some pitfalls too, and sometimes there are things happening behind the screens that aren't quite what they seem. There's things that are kind of shifting us in different directions or making us believe something different or want to buy something different or just be online more, and they're really effective. You know, the average Australian spends more than 2 hours on every day on their phones, more than 2,000 individual touches every day.
Whoa,
we touch them more than we touch anything. And so they're changing us. And, yeah, I wrote a book to tell kids about it.
What about the idea that it makes you, and you write about research, where spending time on some platforms just reliably makes people feel worse. Why do we return to places that make us feel worse?
It's there's a lovely saying, for every time you put your phone down, there's thousands of the world's best paid engineers trying to make you pick it back up again. And they're really good. They're really good programmers. And our brains are really soft. We've kind of evolved out of this like lizard brain, chimpanzee brains, to like have people, you know, pick lice out of her hair and stuff, and we love it. We have an almost infinite capacity for affirmation, for validation, for being liked, for being connected, and that's a beautiful thing. But there's some really good programmers out there who kind of manage to kind of hack or hijack into that a little bit to keep us engaged, to keep us online, so that the bottom line is so that we can scroll past more ads, so that they can get paid more revenue.
And what techniques do you suggest families or households may instigate to combat these?
Tin foil hats for everyone, I reckon. So, pigeons, you know. No. It's a tough one. I think it's tough. Even the toughest part is because, you know, adults, we're hooked a little bit too.
Yeah, what about monkey see, monkey do?
Yeah, exactly, you know. It's, I mean, truly, we're on there, like, you know, and we could say, you know, we're like arranging your social occasions, you know, paying our bills and stuff. And, like, we are doing those things, but we're also just scrolling and on and touching and checking all the time. So that's tough. There's some lovely approaches out there, some advice. There's a whole bunch of different things you can do. One nice thing you can do as a family is talk about a family technology agreement to do it together, to say, hey, these are our times, this is how we want to use tech. This is when we don't want to use tech, these are going to be some tech-free times. We promise if we, you know, this is, we're going to get off the device and we're going to have these kind of warnings and then blah, or if we're going to be using tracking software, which you can do, and it's maybe helpful in some instances, that everyone's informed about it and empowered about it too. So I think the conversations together is the most helpful thing we can do. But beyond that, the really big thing, you know, if we want to get offline, we've got to make the offline world more engaging and more fun and beautiful to be in than the online world. And that's a harder question.
Yeah.
Because it is pretty beautiful.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the outside world, the inside, both. You know, there's stuff to do everywhere. So, like, you know, the real question is we're being ratcheted on these devices, both to consume more and to drive more things and efficiency and stuff of the general engine of the economy. But there is value in slowness that we have perhaps forgotten over time. It's tricky, you know. You can't. I'm standing like a finger wagging old fart now, but. It's tough. It's a tough thing, and I think we're engaging with it more and more. AI is the next frontier of this. We're using it more in our work. People are chatting with them more. Like, maybe one day, you know, who knows, like, what our young people, how they're going to be interacting with it. They're certainly thinking about it. So these are challenging things that humanity's never really had to grapple with before, just the quality and level of engagement and the ability to kind of hack into our dopamine pathways and all the rest of it. So it's tricky.
Can you put on your energy and research in energy and policy hat on and speak to water usage, data centres, energy for AI? This seems like no one necessarily anticipated this. I saw Bill Gates, who's obviously in the news for other reasons, he purchased 3 Mile Island to get that going again. Can you give us a lay of the land?
It's a real question. It's the next step in our kind of technological evolution in some sense. Data centres and AI use about 2% of Australia's electricity currently. It's forecast to be about 12% over the coming 15 years. That's sizable. In Ireland, currently, it's about more than 20%. Now, more than urban homes in Ireland is being used by electricity is being used by data centres.
Wow.
And it's a question, you know. Like, today, everyone alive will remember a world without AI. And in 20 years, we'll be like, oh, how do we live without that thing? You know, how do we live without AI? But it's a question I think we should ask as we design the next kind of evolution of technology. To what end are we willing to build this technology? Are we willing to cover our countryside with panels and wind farms and transmission towers, you know, that have real impact on people, just so that we can have faster chatbots or better whatever algorithm to do something. It's a question, I don't know, that's like, you know, again, the finger wagging tinfoil hat near a lot. But I think these are real questions that we need to ask because they are having and will continue to have an impact on our, certainly on our energy system and the broader kind of ecology that needs to sustain it.
Yeah. Well, you're right. It's such an interesting moment and such a useful contribution to the conversation as well. Behind the screens, how the internet works and how to make it work for you. Tell us about the illustrations briefly.
Oh, amazing. Mm. They're done by Ashka, who's just such an incredible designer illustrator. She actually designed the WikiLeaks Hourglass logo, actually, back in the day. Really cool. Wow. Cool. Whoa. Human. We've got some fun projects coming up ahead too. But no, beautifully illustrated. One of the nice things in the book that she engaged with was the kids themselves, the characters in the book. And we spoke to a whole bunch of kids for the book as well. And their quotes are all the way through it. And some of the best stuff actually out there that's super insightful, super savvy. The kids are going to be all right.
You get more respect from your own kids.
Okay, usually, yeah.
Behind the Screens by Dr. Neeraj Lal is the book and it's out via UQP.
That's right.
Good on you, Neeraj. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Melbourne's own Triple R.
Well, the intellectual cavalry has arrived in the form of film reviewer Megan McHugh. Morning, Megan.
Good morning. What a generous introduction. Thank you. And I am going to put my brain power towards talking about Send Help, which is the latest survival horror comedy thriller directed by Sam Raimi from an original script by Damien Shannon and Mark Swift. So if you are familiar with Raimi's work, you get kind of an idea about what we're in for here. He's probably most famous for the Evil Dead trilogy, which kind of showcases his style a bit. But he did also direct the Spider-Man movies like the Tobey Maguire era and the Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness addition to the Marvel MCU. So this film, look, you should know going in what you're in for. It is a hell of a lot of fun and it is very entertainment forward. It's, like, silly, it's schlocky, it's disgusting, but it is not deliberately, it is not aiming for nuanced social commentary or, like, a deep character study or even biting satire. Like, that is not what we're after here. Raimi is like, let's get you in the seat, get your popcorn out, and let's have a hell of a time.
So there's no weapons or sinners vibe?
No, like I think you got to go in and maybe go in smooth-brained, let's say that. So all that said, let's
talk. My default setting.
So you're good to go. Let's talk through the premise. So we have Linda, played by Rachel McAdams, who I'm happy to see back on my screens. She is a hardworking strategist at a consulting firm, and she's been crunching the numbers for years and years and years with this eventual promotion dangled over her head as an incentive to, you know, keep working hard. Because that always works out, right? You work hard, rewards come as due. But sadly, despite being one of the best there, Linda is socially awkward. She's very eager. She has these very cringy interactions with her co-workers. She's very bad at kind of reading cues. And she's like a little bit rough around the edges. So this does mean she goes overlooked and very underappreciated. And sure enough, when the leadership role, like head of the company, falls to the now late CEO's spoiled son, Bradley, played by Dylan O'Brien, Bradley goes ahead and passes over poor Linda for sort of a more senior role in favour of giving it to his old frat and golfing buddy named Donovan. Classic. Played with gusto by Xavier Samuel, by the way. So obviously this sends Linda over the edge, but she does have one last Hail Mary, which is joining them on a private jet flight to Thailand. So this is Bradley, Donovan, and character whose name I don't know, who's played by Chris Pang, another local. So they're all on this private jet flight, and this is kind of Linda's chance to prove herself to Bradley, you know, get another chance, which is, of course, obviously BS because Bradley's a terrible person. But mid-flight, right, as Bradley and co. are kind of casually bullying Linda, the plane, inevitably, because the film is called Send Help, crashes. And Bradley and Linda wash up on the shore of an island, the only survivors. Sadly, Xavier and Chris Pang meet very gruesome ends. But we're happy about it because they were bad characters. So once we're stranded on the island, this is where we kick into our final gear, because Linda's passion, besides motivational posters, numbers, pet birds and tuna sandwiches, is survival skills.
Wow.
She loves the TV show Survivor. She's got loads of books on different ways to survive in these kind of conditions. So here, Linda is highly capable. And so watching her thrive on the island is about as satisfying as watching poor Bradley suffer, because he is not built for this whatsoever. He's built for boardrooms and, you know, the country club or whatever. Mm. So we see this shift of power start to unfold. So this is, it is your deserted island premise, obviously. It's written on the tin. But Raimi's direction of this kind of whole concept is the definition of unsubtle. And I was thankful for it. Everything here is cranked to 100. It's over the top. And the key to it is both O'Brien and McAdams are so committed to this. Like, they, you have to have actors that are willing to just lean into what this film is doing. And they were there for it. They completely put in the work. Like, these characters, like, there's scenes of them, like, laughing with chewed up food in their mouths. They're on the island. They're gross. Dylan O'Brien has this disgusting laugh that, and you know, vaguely almost manic in a way, but they're just really ready and up for whatever the script has to deliver. And it delivers quite a lot. Is it violent? Yes, very violent. We're talking Sam Raimi here and we're talking Deserted Island. But it's a hyper-violence that's done in a way that's really played for comedy and impact. So I would equate it to an itchy and scratchy cartoon. Or I'd say, similarly, The Substance. You know how The Substance gets pretty gross and wacky by the end, mm-hmm. but it's not scary. I mean, this does have a few jump scares, but I would equate the violence to that. It's done in such a way that you're, it's like splatter gore. You're like, oh, but you're never disturbed. Mm. I mean, maybe you're a little disturbed, but in a way that's fun. And I say that as someone who can be a little, you know, shy squeamish about these things. Yeah, exactly. So the film also, you could be like, but Megan, it's so cliched. This premise has been done 1,000 times. Look at these broad characters. They're basically cartoons. That's the whole point. Like, this is what we're here for, to see this kind of play out. And the film wants you to anticipate what's coming. It's like dropping these breadcrumbs galore for you to pick up. Like, we've got Chekhov's knife, Chekhov's berry, like everything that you could imagine to play out here. The story goes there, and I was very happy that it did. And as well, we have a score by Danny Elfman, who is a collaborator with Raimi on other projects. He's in on the joke. The music is swelling in time with this drama that's happening on the island, and like these little winky overtures and things that just fit really well and kind of start to make you understand that this film is very unserious.
It sounds like a good palate cleanser. Like, it's award seasons now, right?
Yes.
So in between some very serious films, drop in, see this one.
Yes.
I think that's also why it's doing quite well, because it is a really fun one to see at the cinema, because there's a lot of moments, there's some jump scares in there, and there's a lot of moments where you'll want to hide behind your hands and kind of be like, oh, and it's fun. Like, that's part of the collective experience of the cinema, is experience this kind of schlocky silliness as a group. And being like, oh, that's disgusting. I know you think that's disgusting. We're all here thinking this is like a roller coaster. I really enjoyed that, and it made me remember why I like going to see fun things like this at the movies. Like you say, like, it's one thing to go and really be like, okay, I'm thinking, I'm using my brain. Look at all these metaphors. Look at how I can dig into this. But here I was just like, oh, that's gross. Great. What a well done.
And then you leave and there's no homework. Exactly. You don't have to think about it ever again.
Even when I was thinking about this review, I was like, I don't really have to be like, okay, well, now when we look back to the World War II themes of the era, it's like, no. The amount of fake blood used was probably ex-leaders. So what I would say is, it's probably a 90-minute premise, and the film does stretch slightly too long at 2 hours. But I did forgive it, because the last 30 minutes was just like sliding into chaos. And by that point, like, Raimi had kind of gone, let's just make this truly ridiculous and kind of wrap up into this like wild, enjoyable, triumphant conclusion that felt like just a really nice little kind of exclamation point.
On nice. Because there's some ridiculousness in cinema that seems like laziness.
Yeah.
Or like nobody cares, but this seems like ridiculousness expertly done.
Oh, yes. It's all very intentional. And I'd say, you know, looking at the way the sort of the more graphic scenes are handled, like Raimi's there, he's cranking it up to like an 8 and you're like, oh. And then he keeps going and that's where it pushes over into ridiculous, over the top, and starts to like get that tone going correctly. And so that's very masterful. Like you can be over the top and it doesn't land. And I personally, I mean, this film is not going to be for everyone. I think I've already described it in a way that you're going to know if you're ready to go into this and enjoy it. But everything he's doing is very intentional. And that's part of his whole style is, I mean, even his entry into the MCU, like we're talking animated corpses, skulls dripping with blood, like those aren't Marvel things, but that's kind of his stamp. It's like, this is how I tell a story. I did at first wonder where the tension was going to be. Like once we're on the island, I was like, well, this could be lovely. Linda knows what's going on. She can forage water. Look at her. She's built this incredible shelter. Where's the tension going to be? And then, like, Dylan O'Brien, like, wakes up from his, you know, being unconscious or whatever, and he opens his mouth. And I was like, oh, that's where the drama is. This guy's a tool. Like, that's what we're here for. And, again, it's the chemistry between those two characters and their commitment to what the script is that made Send Help a really, really fun film that I enjoyed seeing, especially at the cinema.
Oh, superb. Okay, Send Help, Sam Raimi, and good to see Rachel McAdams.
Yeah.
Really just dialed
sending
up to 11.
It, absolutely. Like, she was...
And you believe her as an awkward...
I really
socially...
did.
Wow.
She's incredible.
All right, you're incredible. Megan McHugh, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Triple R on FM, digital, online and via the app.
Everybody's favourite weekly habit, Dr. Jen, is here and is justifiably glowing.
Woohoo!
Can we?
Sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You want to talk about what I was doing on the weekend?
Yes, please.
Yeah, well, I'm just here as a proud mum, really.
Yes.
My gorgeous son decided that he would do something a bit unusual to celebrate his 18th birthday on Sunday, and rather than party, he spent the whole day running in the heat to raise money for Headspace, which is an amazing youth mental health organisation. And he smashed it, and the community just came out in droves to support. And we're just, yeah, I'm just on this high of amazing people supporting a really, really great endeavour.
How far did he run?
So he ran 100 kilometres in one
what?
Go. Yeah, pretty extraordinary.
That's
and it was
amazing.
It was pretty warm on the day, which we always knew, you know, trying to run that far in mid-February, but he really wanted to do it on his actual 18th birthday.
Ugh. I don't think I've run 100 kilometres cumulatively.
Look, he trained really, really hard for a very long time for it. So, yeah, I'm just sitting here being very, very proud. And, Jace, you know Rowan, you guys have been running together. He's a, yeah.
Incredible,
he did really well.
Incredible effort. That's awesome. And raising money for Headspace, great cause.
Yeah, and a whole lot of the Headspace team came down on the day. And, yeah, it's just a really lovely local community organisation.
What a weirdly determined family you've got.
Rowan,
well,
Marty, Richie.
That was all his own idea. It didn't come anywhere from us.
Congratulations.
Him. Yeah, thank you.
Well, and there's other good news about.
Yeah, I thought we should talk about this one because I'm sure a lot of us will have heard about it or seen it in the news late last week. We didn't manage to quite sneak it in for last Wednesday, but there was this big long-term study that came out looking at coffee and dementia, and I feel like they're two really important things in lots of people's lives, and I thought we should talk about it. So it's a really big study which was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, which was one of the big hitters in kind of medical science research. And the reason I think it got a lot of airtime, as it should, is because it was this massive, massive study. So 130,000 people, both men and women, and they were followed for a period of up to 43 years. So that's, you know, decades of data on diet and health and cognition. And this meant that they could look at how often people people drank tea and coffee over a lot of their adult lives, rather than just a lot of studies are kind of a snapshot, you know, how many teas or coffees have you had today or this week or whatever. And then essentially they linked that habit of consuming coffee and tea with whether people over that 43-year period developed dementia or not. So it's a really powerful study. And in this study, over that time, around 11,000 people of the 130,000 did develop dementia. And early prevention is really crucial for dementia because once symptoms appear, it's quite hard to treat. You know, there's not that much that we can do. And dementia is this huge issue, obviously. So this study was carried out in the US, but in Australia, I looked this morning, about 450,000 Australians are living currently with some form of dementia, and that number is expected to climb to over 1 million Australians over the next 40 years as our population ages. So that's a lot of people.
Is my maths right? That's almost in the 1%, but climbing to about 4% of the population.
I'll tell you what.
I'm glad you're doing
the maths. In a conversation about cognitive decline, to attempt spontaneous maths is heroic.
Everyone's going to suddenly be texting in, Jace, oh my gosh, we're really worried about you. It's worth knowing. So it means that dementia is one of the leading causes of death in Australia, particularly among older Australians, but it's also one of the major contributors to disability and loss of these kind of healthy later years. Anyway, so as you may have heard, what they found in the study is pretty awesome. They found that people who consume moderate amounts of caffeinated coffee, we'll come to decaf later, but caffeinated coffee, which looked at like 2 to 3 cups a day, these people have a significantly lower risk of developing dementia in their lifetime compared with people who drink little or no coffee. So that's kind of the headline finding, which is pretty amazing. So essentially you've got about an 18% lower risk of developing dementia if you're in the group having the higher coffee intake versus the lower coffee intake. And those people who are drinking more coffee are tending to report less of the things that we might notice ourselves, like memory lapses or kind of slower thinking, you know, when you just feel your brain's kind of foggy, so things that you can notice yourself. And in women, some of the kind of objective cognitive tests that you can do to test for dementia, women who drank more coffee did perform better in these. It wasn't as strong in men. So, and to be clear, this was only associated with caffeinated coffee. Decaf did not show the same results. Tea showed similar associations with rather than 2 to 3 cups a day, it was 1 to 2 cups per day.
Yeah, and sorry, does that relate to caffeine as well for the tea?
Yep.
Yeah.
The caffeine is a stimulant.
Well, we think, right? I mean, the thing to be really clear is, you know, so the obvious thing you want to jump to and say, woohoo, coffee prevents dementia, all my problems are solved. As long as I drink coffee every day, I'm not going to develop dementia. Now, of course, we know it's not that simple. This is an observational study. We can't prove causation. We can show correlation. But, of course, the study was done properly. So the first thing you might think is, but hang on, maybe people who drink coffee also have other lifestyle habits that make them less likely, you know, to protect their brain, essentially. Things like they might be more social, or they might do more exercise. They might just be healthier in general because they go out walking every day with their friends and drinking their coffee. Or you could say that people who have poor sleep or anxiety are advised not to drink caffeine, and so those things may also be increasing the risk of dementia. So, you know, it's obviously complicated, and we can't say, here's the smoking gun, all you have to do is drink coffee. But the study was done properly. It was rigorous. So they did control for lots of things, like whether people smoked, what the rest of their diet was like, whether they exercised, what their body mass was. You know, they controlled for all those things the best they could. But it is an observational study. So there are things about coffee that could lead us to think that it could be protective to the brain. So things like, we know that caffeine blocks a molecule in your brain called adenosine, and that is a molecule that dampens brain activity. So if you block it by having more caffeine, then maybe that keeps the signalling in your brain more active. So that could be what's going on. It could be that we know coffee and tea are also both rich in a whole lot of other compounds, plant compounds that are really good for us, that reduce inflammation, that sort of thing. So there are plausible reasons. We also know that coffee's been linked to a lower risk of type 2 diabetes, and type 2 diabetes is also a risk factor for dementia. So there's logical reasons to think this could be actually kind of the smoking gun for how we prevent dementia, but we don't, we can't prove that yet. But it's just a pretty cool study. And I guess the thing that I like about it the most is I still hear really commonly people saying things like, oh, yeah, I should cut back. You know, I know coffee's not good for me. I shouldn't drink. And, oh, it's really bad. I have two a day kind of thing. And this study is adding to this quite big weight of evidence we have now that suggests that coffee's not bad for you at all, unless it's making you stressed or it's leading you not to be able to sleep or, you know, like, of course, for you as an individual, yeah, maybe it upsets your gut, whatever it is. Like, I'm not saying everyone has to drink coffee, and I personally don't drink coffee. Caffeine doesn't work well for me. But if it's working well for you, this is just more another suggestion to say, don't feel you should cut back. Enjoy it. If it's a lovely, rewarding piece of your life and you enjoy drinking coffee, it's also potentially quite good for you.
I wonder how many people news like this tips them over into being coffee drinkers, or how much of the weird science that you bring changes people's behaviour. Do you hear anecdotally of people being persuaded by the efficacy of some scientific findings?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's why I do this, right? That's why I love coming in here week after week for so many years, because I feel like there's a lot of really useful information that's out there in the world of scientific research that most people don't get access to otherwise. They're not reading the journals like I try and do. I mean, something like this, of course, made it into the headlines because it's such a captivating story. Drink coffee and you'll have a longer, healthier life. But there's so much great science being done all around the world that has direct relevance to the decisions we make about how we run our lives. And I love finding that, working out what they found out, checking that it was accurate, and then coming in and working out how to share that story with you. And this one, you know, you know, we've got to take a little bit of thought about how we take this result. It doesn't mean that drinking coffee means that you don't need sleep or you don't need to exercise or you don't need to eat well if you want to live a long, healthy life. Sorry, Daniel, but you need to do all those other things as well. It's never going to be a magic bullet that's just going to fix your brain health, but it's just kind of a nice tidbit, right? That maybe if coffee is a part of your life that brings you joy and a sense of well-being, keep it up, because this suggests, and of course this is going to lead to more and more research, this suggests that maybe it's a really good thing that you should keep enjoying, which is a nice good news
story,
really.
Do you drink tea?
No, caffeine's actually really bad for me. I don't have a good response to caffeine.
What an easy guest you are.
Well, it's a bit boring though, right? Because, you know, you go to someone's house and they're like, what can I offer you, tea, coffee? And I say, oh, can I have a glass of water, please?
Yeah, right. You're suspicious of everyone's machine. Dr. Jan, congratulations on raising such an extraordinary child. And thank you very much. We'll catch you next week.
Yeah, see you next week.
Triple R.
Of composure, Oliver Coleman joins us as our Friday funny bugger. Morning, Oliver. Goodness gracious.
Jonathan Oliver. Is that another? That's another host, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. Exactly. Yes.
Well,
a less successful comedian.
Less successful comedian, but gosh, let's get him on Friday funny bugger, please.
How are you, mate? I've missed you.
I've missed you. I haven't seen you guys in a while. Do I look different?
You look hot.
Do I look hot?
Yeah.
Is it like an aura thing? Do you think my aura is kind of
vivacious or something?
I agree. It's kind of vivacious.
It's got
It's got this kind of glowing.
Have you had a haircut?
That's someone.
Well, I have had a haircut, but I don't think it's just that, Bron. It's something else, right?
I think it's the hair. I think the haircut's doing a lot of heavy lifting.
The haircut is doing.
I don't know. Your skin looks. You look
glowing.
Yeah.
Glowing.
There's been an interior vibe shift. Definitely.
I think Daniel's onto it. A spiritual, maybe, awakening.
Really?
Sense of enlightenment.
Maths. You've been watching maths.
And it's...
I've been watching maths, guys. I heard the chat on the way over, and I thought, these people are on my level. I went on a meditation retreat.
Wow. How long?
10 days.
What?
10? Is this one of the silent ones?
Yeah, it's one of the silent ones. One of the 10-day.
That's awesome.
Silent. No talkie. No talkie, no phone. No, nothing. No books. No writing materials. No eye contact. Just you and the landscape of your interior mind.
No eye contact is a good rule. If you've got nothing, it would be so weird to just be walking around with intense eye contact and not being able to follow it up with a hello, how you going?
Can you chill out?
Yeah, can you back up a bit?
Because you would be trying to have conversations with your eyes,
yeah,
just like looking at each other really intently.
Do you think there was like one guy that ruined it? Then they were like, that's it, no more eye contact. That guy, it was too much. Never again.
And there was a guy there when I was there. You could tell he was always trying to catch your eye. And it was like, just get out of here.
I know I'm glowing, but chill.
Yeah, it was. I've never done anything like that before, but a friend did. And I thought, you know, I've always been interested in meditation. I don't have the discipline or the willpower to do it in my real life, or to keep to any sort of routine. So I was just like, well, I'll just dive in.
Yeah.
I'll just jump on in.
Straight in.
Do it for 10 days. And
then never again.
And let's be frank, I haven't done it once since. Yeah. you wake up at 4:30 in the morning, and then you meditate, and then you go to bed at 9:30 p.m.
This is Dalai Lama territory.
You eat, you get a meal at breakfast and lunchtime, and then you get a piece of fruit at like 5 p.m.
What's the fruit?
Oh, mate, it was this was the most exciting part of my day.
I want to know.
I wanted to know as well. The peaches were stellar.
Oh, yum.
Banana, apple, orange. I really got into the oranges. And let me tell you, my taste buds were firing on all cylinders.
They'd be pinging.
They were pinging because I didn't have any other kind of sensory. My dopamine had, like, returned to, you know, the base level. So I would have an orange and it was like, wow.
Blow your mind.
I'm eating an iPhone or something. It was just wonderful.
I'd be upset on Apple Day.
Yeah, Apple Day. Ugh. Apple Day's the worst.
What? So it's like a long-haul flight where there's nothing to look forward to, so you're mad for the meal time.
Exactly right, exactly right.
And then how many days did it take a while for you to get into a groove?
I reckon it took maybe 4 days. And it's mainly, and you sit there cross-legged for however long. So it's like 10 days of, you know, severe back pain and
poor circulation.
Eating lentils. Poor circulation. Yeah, my I was getting lots of pins and needles. I needed some of those flight stockings so I didn't get deep vein.
The pressure.
Thrombosis.
The pressure socks.
Yeah, I needed some pressure socks.
Like, it's lots of prepping meals, lots of cleaning and tidying, that kind of stuff?
No, you do all that at the end. There's other people who've done it before who come and volunteer and do that stuff for
so
you.
So what do you do all day?
You sit in a hall and think about your breathing.
Wow,
that's a lot.
Will this have residual effects for the rest of your life, or have they remained with you?
No.
How long until you picked up your phone when you got out?
Like I tried to not do it for like, and it was like 2 hours. And let me tell you, I think that was the best thing, like not reading the news. You know, I was, it was just
cleansed,
you know. I was happier not knowing that Noam Chomsky was hanging out with Jeffrey Epstein, you know. It's nice. It was a silent retreat. The one thing, I slept in like a dorm. And you, no talking, not a word for 10 days, except the guy sleeping like a couple of beds down, hectic sleep talker.
Yes.
Yes.
Loophole.
It was this. Yeah, I know. Get this guy out of here. He said a couple of funny things. He was like this really small, kind of like lanky 22, like tiny guy. And then in his sleep, he had the voice of like a 70-year-old Vietnam War veteran or something.
Huge. Oh, the voice you put on when you think someone's breaking into your house.
Something like that. All his dreams sounded like hectic. He woke me up one morning at 3 a.m. going, someone's gone and used up all the bloody oranges. That was one that I really liked. He must have been about the fruit thing.
It must have been the fruit.
Yeah.
Was he on to you?
He was on to me.
But was it really sleep talking, or did he want to send a message?
I think, maybe. Maybe there was some passive aggression going on.
What's it when you're in character?
K-fab.
K-fab, yeah.
K-fab. This guy was K-fabbing. He was K-fabbing a Vietnam War veteran.
So, I mean, I want to know everything. I mean, obviously this is a new year, new me kind of vibe.
No, not really. I've thought about doing it for ages, actually, but then it's I'm not doing a comedy festival show this year, so I had the time. I'm like the opposite of Bron right now. Bron's like,
no, we're the same. We both don't have shows.
True, but right now you're not present. You're just like, I need to write a show.
Oh yeah, I'm gone.
You're absolutely not here. Whereas this year I've had the time, so I was like, well, I'll give it a go.
Now that you're saying it, and I'm thinking, God, this sounds like material. Should I book in for a retreat?
You should. You should. Yeah. You should absolutely take these. Take 10 days.
10 days.
Take 10 days.
Can't write anything down though. I mean, was that maddening?
Not being able to write anything down. It was a little bit maddening, and I had some like comedy thoughts and ideas, and I was like, oh, and I tried to like accept that they. I actually remembered a hearing about a Tom Waits quote where I remember him. There's a story of him like driving along the highway or something in LA, and he had like this beautiful idea for a song, and he just said to him, he said, "Oh, not now." I thought that was quite like sweet.
Did it come back
for Tom?
Yeah.
Well, something came back because he had some very successful songs.
But did we get that song?
No, we didn't get that song. And for me, I haven't. No material came back for me.
Material.
Yeah, I was like, let me tell you, I had some gold. And since then, nothing good.
What about the first time you opened your mouth and started talking? Was that blowing the cobwebs out mentally and verbally?
That was actually tricky because at the end, you're allowed to talk on like the afternoon of the last day, like I suppose. You know, give you a soft landing into the real world. And it's just like, it is a really awkward moment at the end. You kind of, you like all stand there and you're just like, like that. You don't really know what to say. And you just go, oh,
I remember how was that for you?
Yeah.
Did everyone's voice suit their face?
Yeah, well, you know what was interesting is I feel like you didn't talk for 10 days, but you'd still kind of look at everyone. And for some reason, even without talking, there were people I hated. And
people, they opened their mouths and go like, oh, it's even worse.
Well, actually, there was one guy. For some reason, there was one guy, and I looked at him and I was like, oh, I hate your tattoos. You're the worst person in the world. And then I was like, yeah, I'm really, this guy's lovely. Yeah. I was absolutely joking.
Judge the book by the cover.
All right. Well, and we didn't even get to what you've been up to.
No. Oh, well, that's the thing. And then I got out of there. I was feeling very calm and peaceful and happy. And then the day I got out, I got a letter from my real estate saying that we have to vacate. And I was like, well,
all that good work's been undone.
All that good work has been undone as I enter the throng and dog-eat-dog world of rental inspections.
Oh. Chomsky in an eviction. Welcome back to Earth.
Love it. Good to be here.
That's quite a gear
Alden
change.
Coleman, thanks so much, mate.
Thanks. Triple R.
You've been listening to a podcast of the best bits of Breakfasters, which is the Monday to Friday breakfast show, broadcast live on Triple R from Melbourne, Australia. Feel free to get in touch with Breakfasters via Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or via the Triple R website.